The flurry of business-friendly, budget-squeezing legislation being passed by the Republican-led General Assembly? It makes perfect sense to one freshman Democrat in the Senate.
They finally have, you know, green lights all down the boulevard, and they're going 100 miles an hour.
Senator John Rizzo of Kansas City this week on State House Blend, Missouri. From KCUR 89.3, this is State House Blend, Missouri. I'm Brian Ellison. We'll talk with John Rizzo in a moment, but first, some of the issues we have to talk about in Jefferson City this week. The General Assembly set itself on a collision course with the state's two largest cities on the minimum wage issue. On Thursday, the House passed a bill to say cities, and they're talking about you, Kansas City and St. Louis, can't raise their own hourly minimum above the state level, which is currently $7.70 an hour. St. Louis Democrat Carla May found that ironic.
It amazes me how many times people get up on this floor and talk about the intrusion of federal government on state government. Yet and still, we're getting ready to intrude on local government. It's hypocrisy. Come on!
The Kansas City, Missouri Council had another response. That very afternoon, they voted to pass an increase to the city's wage anyway, eventually reaching $13 over several years. Should the House bill become law, off to court we go. The House and Senate cranked away at a number of other bills moving through the committee process this week. Anti-abortion bills that would increase inspections at clinics or declare fetuses to be persons under the law. Bills to explicitly permit but also regulate transportation networking companies like Uber and Lyft. And a bill to increase the penalty for certain crimes committed by immigrants who are deported for committing a crime, return to the U.S. illegally, and then commit another violent crime. Republican Mike Cunningham says federal authorities need the state to put these immigrants behind bars.
They can't do the job all by themselves, and with the number they're deporting right now, it's an unbelievable number they're deporting right now. And so if we can save a life or save somebody from getting beat, a spousal abuse or something like that, I think we need to do it.
Some Democrats supported the bill, others saw political opportunism and an unnecessary burden on state taxpayers. And attention shifted outside the Capitol to an office building across the street. The Kansas City Star and other media outlets reported the creation of a new nonprofit by senior aides of Governor Eric Greitens. A New Missouri, Inc. will be staffed by Greitens' relatives and even current state employees in the governor's office, advocating for the governor's agenda without any requirement to disclose its donors. It's legal, but it hasn't set well with many who have noted the governor's campaign that leaned hard on cleaning up ethics in Jeff City. This weekend, the state's two largest newspapers published an unusual joint editorial, Kansas City Star and the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, calling for a more transparent governorship. That's a call also being issued by Democrats, including our guest today, Senator John Rizzo.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me back.
And also joining us is KCUR's national correspondent and senior editor, Frank Morris. Hey, Frank.
Hey, how's it going, Brian?
Good to have you back on The Blend.
Great to be here.
It does seem like maybe you've been keeping your head down a little bit in your first year in office, but you were in the news a couple of times this week.
Sure.
You spoke on the floor about the immigration deportation bill. We can talk about that in a minute. You also talked about the Uber or the ride-sharing company's bill, where you offered an amendment. What's going on with that bill? We know it passed over in the House. What's happening in the Senate?
So Uber has been trying to pass legislation for quite a while, the last 3 or 4 years, and it kind of stemmed from they were working with the city of Kansas City and they were working with the city of St. Louis, and the city of Kansas City and Uber kind of came to an agreement, but they could never come to an agreement in St. Louis. Mostly the taxicab commission in St. Louis was having some issues, obviously, with Uber. And they just can never come to agreement. So Uber took it to the state level to have some framework, and it failed a few times, which I think the legislature was trying to encourage them to get this done at the local levels. And they continue to bring it back. I am not a big fan of the company of Uber. I think the service is a good idea, and I get that. And I think that picking up your phone and everything else and, you know, seeing the cars and them coming to you is a great thing. But Uber, as I'm sure many people have seen in the news the last few weeks, has just stumbled continuously when it comes to doing the right thing. And
like what?
Well, I'll tell you, a perfect example would be my amendment that I did. So I found out that Uber had instituted this thing called Project Grayball. And Project Grayball was a started in countries outside of the United States where rival cab companies would call an Uber and then maybe have an altercation with the Uber driver to kind of push them out of the area or the network, so on. So they figured out that they could hide those drivers from certain people. And then that spawned into, well, they were operating illegally in St. Louis because they had no agreement with the city of St. Louis, but they were still operating. And they figured out that they could draw what's called a geofence around the police departments, anybody that was trying to thwart their attempt to do ride sharing, even though they were operating illegally. And there were even some cases where not only would you try to pull the app up and see a car if you were inside a police station, sometimes you wouldn't see any cars to be able to go and, say, do a sting operation or whatever. Sometimes they'd put like 30 cars up that didn't exist.
Fictional cars.
Yeah, wow. To send them down kind of a rabbit hole.
You almost have to admire the ingenuity of that, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So...
So your amendment.
So what did it do?
Yeah. So I brought an amendment up that basically said that they could no longer geofence around law enforcement. Another way they were capturing law enforcement agents through the app was by their credit cards or debit cards. Usually, if they are operating, say, a sting operation or things like that, they use a government credit card or debit card. And once they found out that this person that was trying to hail the ride was a police officer or some sort of law enforcement, they would cancel the ride. And they could identify that by the card they were using on file. So you couldn't do that. I made it to where they couldn't basically evade law enforcement anymore. They couldn't draw geofences around police departments and government buildings to try to evade law enforcement.
I know you also had some concerns about refusal to provide service in certain parts of town, for example.
Well, yes, and this was more of a contentious issue on that amendment because of the kind of, and this happens in the Senate, the generational gap that probably me and some of my younger colleagues have, with some of the older colleagues. And many people, I'm sure, are aware of redlining and things like that, where certain companies don't service certain areas for maybe socioeconomic reasons or whatever. And all I wanted the to do was to make sure that Uber put up on the app every available fare. And, you know, we are not forcing people to go into the district or into the area. We're not forcing people to go pick people up in certain places. But if a driver wants to see who is, you know, asking for rides in certain areas and go into those areas, they should be able to do that. And that was kind of the disconnect that we had, was there were certain senators that thought, oh, we're going to make them go into those areas. And that's not what we were doing. We were just saying, make everything available. And, you know, they are more of independent contractors and it's their decision. They carry their own insurance. So if they decide that they want to be the only person operating in you know, certain areas and make a bunch of money, that's the decision that they should be able to make.
Sure. Sure. Well, very good.
What was Uber's rationale for excluding some areas?
So they would draw certain geofences around. The geofencing is the thing you kind of got to wrap your mind around, which is basically, if you take the word geo away, it's a fence.
Right. But what excuse parts of town?
They had not done it yet.
Oh.
But the way that I felt is with Uber in the news, and in my personal opinion, I think we're going to get one crack at this, and I don't see us coming back to this next year if it passes and everything else. So I just wanted to drill down as tightly as I could on a company that has had bad practices.
And which has poured a pretty fair amount of money into the Missouri legislature this year.
I would assume. I haven't talked to them very much because they know how I feel about the company. And it personally, in my opinion, the reason to move this bill forward is so Lyft could come into the Kansas City and St. Louis markets. Because unlike Uber, Lyft won't come until there's regulation. They won't try to evade authorities to get into a market. they will just they're going to wait until everything is done correctly and on the up and up. And in my personal opinion, that's why you pass this piece of legislation so Uber, so Lyft can come in and eventually, in my opinion, push Uber out.
Frank, what else is on your mind?
Well, I saw that a whole bunch of gun control measures sort of came up in the Senate. And I'm just wondering, why bother, you know, with this General Assembly?
So I don't know if we've had any gun issues on the floor as of...
Well, these were just coming up last week, you know, a number of, you know, just little gun control measures. You know, they're not on the floor, but these are just coming up. I just wondered, you know...
People are introducing bills.
Oh, sure. Yeah, maybe through committee.
Yeah.
In my personal opinion, I think they've pretty well cut to the bone on gun issues. And so, look, I think this session, in my opinion, is going to be about tort reform and about labor union busting. And they have not had a Republican governor, supermajority House, supermajority Senate, I don't know if ever. And the last time they had a Republican up and down all the way was with Governor Blunt. And I do think that they are going to take their time this year and do broad, sweeping, big pieces of legislation. They don't care how long it's going to take them. And next year they will do stuff that will help people's district. But this year is about the big stuff. This year is about right to work. This year is about, you know, going after trial attorneys that they dislike, and you know the old standbys that usually would politically help Democrats. They've been chomping at the bit to get after for years. They finally have, you know, green lights all down the boulevard, and they're going 100 miles an hour.
Another of those pro-business bills that happened this week was the minimum wage increase prohibition, essentially telling St. Louis and Kansas City that they cannot increase the minimum wage above the state level, which is $7.70.
Yeah.
Kansas City, hours after the House passed that bill, went ahead and voted. The Kansas City Council voted to raise the minimum wage gradually to $13 an hour. They will debate in August, raising it further to $15 an hour, all while the state very well may ban such increases in the first place. How do you come down on that? I mean, you've served in state politics now for 6 years. Does the state have a legitimate role in setting a minimum wage for the entire state?
Yeah, I think that they do. And I think it's unfortunate that we don't increase it. And, you know, in a perfect world, and in my personal opinion, I think the best practice is to do it statewide. But this legislature has been so, I guess, deaf to what people are saying in Kansas City and St. Louis and throughout the state that they want a higher minimum wage. And they have just thumbed their nose at people that have proposed that for years, that they have done what everybody usually does and they've taken it into their own hands. And these municipalities have finally drawn a line in the sand. And so Kansas City acted, I believe yesterday or the day before.
Thursday, yeah.
Thursday, to get ahead of the legislation that's coming down the pipe probably next week in the Senate. It's already passed the House that would preempt a minimum wage, increase. And instead of letting these things happen, that certain Republicans always preach local control. We love local control. And so when the local municipality actually goes out and does a proactive thing, they're going to preempt it now.
Well, it seems like local control, unless it's St. Louis or Kansas City.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. And so I give kudos to the city council members and the people out there that have decided to vote for the minimum wage and increase it. It's long overdue. Will it possibly create some problems between Kansas City and, you know, other outlying municipalities that have not done the increase in minimum wage? Yeah, it might. It's very possible. That's why it should be done statewide.
You know, it strikes me that a lot of people who work at minimum wage or close to minimum wage jobs, people who would benefit from an increased minimum wage, working class folks, voted Republican. Sure. They have voted for those Republicans in the state legislature. They voted for a president who are on the opposite side of this issue. What do you make of that? Or maybe it's a question. Maybe it's a political question. Why have you and your fellow Democrats failed to reach those voters if you think you're acting in their interest?
Yeah. Well, it's why do people vote against their own self-interest? Is I guess the eternal question that we would have as Democrats, because
they do because you haven't made your case, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no. I there's no doubt anymore, in my personal opinion, Democrats as a party are so much better at this economy thing than Republicans. You know, George W. Bush left an economy in shambles. President Obama, through 8 years in the Great Recession, close to another Great Depression, has left Donald Trump with an economy that has the wind at its back. I mean, everything is moving in the right direction. He picks it up, and same thing with President Clinton. Comes in, inherits a recession, and we have probably the best 8 years that I'll ever see in my lifetime of economic growth. We had a surplus when he leaves office, completely squandered and into a bailout by the time George W. Bush leaves office. So I don't know why we're not selling that message. I don't know why we're not sitting around in a room and talking about how we can explain to people, when it comes to economics, when it comes to a booming, thriving economy, we're just better at it. Mm. We look at policy and economic engines, and we know how to run an economy much better.
That's so abstract, though, compared to I'm looking out for you. I'm your guy in Jefferson City.
Sure.
And these other guys are evil.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, how do you, there's got to be a stronger way of framing that if you're trying to sell that.
Well, I would argue that if you take out the hyperbole of Donald Trump and the outlandish things he said, his message was very similar to Bernie Sanders. You know, the going into working class families, you know, all of this, we're gonna give, which he said, I mean, it's probably clearly obviously not going to happen, but we're going to give health care to everybody. Mm-hmm. You know, he said on TV multiple times, as Bernie Sanders would say, and the government's going to pay for it, as Donald Trump said. And because we're going to be saving so much money and winning. But if you take out his outlandish things and awful things that he said, he played to the same people that Bernie Sanders was playing to, and it was the throw the bums out type mentality. And, you know, and I would even argue that if you'd have told me a year and a half, 2 years ago, that the nominee was going to lose Missouri by almost 20 points and Jason Kander was going to lose to Roy Blunt by 3, that I don't think we're in as bad a shape as people want to say or put out there. I mean, Jason Kander loses to what I would consider a Missouri icon by 3 points in a year where the presidential nominee loses by 20. Chris Koster loses, I believe, by 5 or 6 points in a year where the nominee loses by almost 20. The presidential nominee, excuse me. Yeah. And so it's just like, there's some silver linings in there.
All right. Well, what else is on your mind, Frank? What other issues in the General Assembly you think we should talk about today?
Well, I guess there's the ethics thing. I mean, you know, we've got another sort of drain the swamp administration ostensibly in Governor Greitens. And you see him, you know, like a lot of other governors, setting up a nonprofit, I guess, across the street from the governor's mansion or
right.
the state house.
A lot of reporting this week in the Kansas City Star, Jason Hancock in particular, talking about a new Missouri, a nonprofit that the governor will not be involved in the day-to-day operations of, but his senior aides and some of his relatives will be on their staff and in some case working for the governor and this new nonprofit at the same time.
Sure.
And collecting money in completely oblique ways. There's no way to trace the funding coming into this organization or what the funding is.
No limits.
And so, I mean, you know, there's that, and that's legal, you know. But I guess I sort of broadly wonder if there's a Democratic, you know, Rex Singfield or, you know, that trucking magnate who's funding, you know, Greitens, you know, is there an equivalent? Is there, I mean, what's the funding gap between Democrats and Republicans, if there is one?
Oh, there's a huge funding gap. The Republican Party has done a national Koch brothers system that I believe that the governor and many of other people, a lot of these statewide, the attorney general now, they have tapped into. And it's a huge, huge discrepancy of the money that they get pouring in.
Is there any way to put a dollar figure on it?
Well, I think the number that I had heard in the primary alone, Rex Singenfeld, I believe, spent $11 million.
Yeah,
and did not win one race.
Well, that's one guy. I mean,
that's one guy who's going on big.
But I mean, just in general terms, I mean, do we know what
the most expensive governor's race that we've ever had? I want to say that each one of them raised and spent close to $30 million a piece.
Right, I think that's right. And Eric Greitens' supporter, David Humphreys, the Joplin mm-hmm. businessman. Was far more successful than Singenfeld this year.
Yes,
and managed to get well. I mean, was certainly a big part of Governor Greitens being elected.
Yeah,
I mean, what's your response to this? You're a legislator. I guess one of those corrupt career politicians condemned during the campaign by Governor Greitens. How do you respond when you hear of this nonprofit, this so-called dark money, being coming into play?
Well, it's kind of the do as I say, not as I do mentality. He preaches ethics and transparency, but yet we don't know where that $2 million came from that he took just before the limits kicked in. We don't know anything about this new venture that he's got coming in. The plane was another issue that nobody's quite sure how he's getting around and getting to back and forth to D.C. Mm-hmm. So it's like I find
so it's a transparency issue.
It's a say what you will. Back in the days when we had no limits. It forced you. You can take as much as you needed, I guess, so to speak. But you had to show where it came from.
And in fairness, you had a lot of money in your Senate campaign.
Yeah, yeah. And but everything was disclosed. Everything is right there for everybody to go look up on the internet. These new 501c3s, and I guess they're not really new anymore, but this like 501c3s that the governor is putting together, or his staff or whatever. They show. Not one donor. They show no campaign limits. Another thing you can do with that 501c3 that you can't do with a state committee is use the funds for federal office. So if I, like with my Senate campaign committee, I'll be running for reelection in 4 years and I'll be raising money up until I run for reelection. But maybe I decide, I want to go and run for Congress. Instead, I can't take that money from a state political action committee, my state campaign committee, and turn it into John Rizzo for Congress committee.
Right.
501c3, you can do that.
So why don't you have one?
That's the bigger question that us as Democrats are going to have to at some point sit down and talk about, because we have been complaining about this dark money for years and years and years, and you look up, and now a governor is pretty well out there with it. And this is happening all over in Washington, D.C., and we are just continually getting slaughtered by this dark money. So at a certain point, maybe we do need to sit down and say, it's unlimited and we can take it from wherever, so maybe we should start doing the same thing. And it's unfortunate that we would get to a point to where there'd be less transparency, but the guy's governor, it's clearly working. And we'll see in 4 years, but I would hope that we could just be on a level playing field, disclose our donors, and go from there.
I do want to ask you about one other issue in the Senate this week before we go, and that's the legislation around immigration, particularly a bill that would make it would strengthen the penalties for mm-hmm. those who are deported and then reenter the country illegally and commit crimes
yes.
again.
Mm-hmm.
You opposed that bill in the Senate.
No, I actually voted for the bill.
You voted for the bill, but...
So on the floor, my biggest concern on that bill was the fiscal oversight of the bill. So basically, what would happen now is if somebody reenters and commits, and the crimes were pretty bad.
These were serious,
domestic violence, right. Things like that. And what the sponsor said continually happened was they were turned over to ICE and then deported. And then this would be if they reentered, and not just reentry, but committed another pretty bad crime, that they would then go to prison, as anybody else would. And so my concern with the bill was the fiscal responsibility of it. That was my question on the floor, was how many new prisoners are we going to have? It's expensive to house people. So I was just trying to be fiscally responsible and ask the question of, we don't really know the impact financially, what it would be to the state, because they were turned over to ICE, they were deported. And we don't really have a gauge of that.
Yeah, is there any sense that this is an actual problem that's being addressed, or is this just addressing, a phantom problem?
I would say that the president has done a very good job at selling some of these heinous crimes that have happened in other states. He points to the situation in California all the time, where an illegal immigrant had murdered a woman, and so you are seeing a lot of what I would call sister legislation throughout the states. But
I mean, is there any indication that this happened? I mean, is there a heinous crime in Missouri that everybody points to?
He had had some examples, and in my personal opinion, the stuff in the language in the bill, the crimes that were going to be committed were pretty awful.
Right, but yeah. Does it happen? I mean, the question is this just talking about immigration and, you know, perhaps demonizing immigrants for just something to talk about?
The political gain.
Political, vibe. Yeah.
You would have to take that up with a sponsor, honestly, and mm-hmm. the floor leader. They definitely, as we saw with SJR 39, introduced legislation and passed legislation for political gain.
Is that what's happening? I mean, do you think that's what's happening here? I mean, because it puts you in a position where I think I hear you saying that this isn't a bill you would have introduced, but you voted for it.
Sure.
You felt, maybe, did you feel like you had to?
I felt like if we're going to put people in jail that are Missourians for doing the exact same crime, why should we not have something on the books if somebody else does? I mean, I'll tell you, like I told the senator on the floor, the sponsor, I have two little girls, and your world changes when you have little kids. And whether the bill is politicized or whatever it might be, if you're going to commit those crimes and, domestic violence, rape, I believe one of them was dealing drugs, things like that, then if there is one case like that, maybe there's two. I mean, it would solve that problem. All I know is, being in the minority, the bill was presented in front of me.
Right.
You'd have to take up with the floor leader and the sponsor as to why or what the reasoning was. But you present the bill in front of me, and I have to vote on it. I'm going to vote for protections.
Mm-hmm. Any last thoughts, Frank Morris?
There's a bill to limit the size, to reduce the size of the General Assembly.
Mm-hmm.
Is that going anywhere? I mean, because that's such a great idea.
I hope so. Honestly, in my personal opinion, if I could wave a magic wand, I'd probably make it 99 in the House. Probably leave the Senate alone. I think the Senate is probably 34 is a pretty good number, and we cover each district's about 175,000 people.
One of the biggest state legislatures in the country.
Yeah. Yeah. Because of the House.
Yeah.
Yeah. So each Senate district is 175,000. I think that's, I know I'm pretty busy day to day. And in the House, there are some people down there that we could do without. to be very kind.
Would you like to? I mean, there's like a level of complexity that I mean, it's just, you know, not necessarily helpful.
Right. Yeah. It's a lot of people to manage. Each of them representing not a very large number of people.
Yeah, right. And I'll tell you, even past floor leaders, and I won't tell you which ones, will tell you the good number for them, and it is probably around 85 or 90 in the majority of the 163. Because once you get into that 116 number, 117 number, wherever, I believe, right where they're at right now, you can't do middle-of-the-road legislation as much as you have to take up some of this hard-right legislation. I've had floor leaders in the past just point-blank tell me, I wish we had about 87, 88 Republicans. Hmm. And with the size being 163, that's what that's done. It's allowed them to get to 117. And so what reducing that would do is you would get more moderate ideas. You would give more weight to Kansas City and St. Louis reps, in my personal opinion, too, which is probably why you won't see it.
Right. Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds like the bill's got no chance.
You just condemned it to never, ever passing.
Yeah.
Well, I really appreciate you being here with us. First of all, Frank Morris, thank you so much for being on State House Blend. And Senator John Rizzo, Democrat from Kansas City, it is our custom on the broadcast version of this program to end with a song of your choosing, a song that somehow reflects this moment in the life of politics in Missouri. What song comes to mind for you?
I believe right before I got out of my car, I think I was listening to Luckenbach, Texas by Waylon Jennings.
And how does that reflect Missouri right now?
I don't know. It was the last song that I was listening to, and you said it reminded me of the moment. That was the last one that I can remember.
The successful life we're living's got us feuding like the Hatfields and McCoys.
That's right.
Actually, that seems completely appropriate, doesn't it? All right. Thanks so much, John. Good to have you here. State House Blend Missouri is produced by Matt Hodapp. Remember to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Post a review there if you like what you hear. And don't forget, you can find us now on NPR One, the app. Just search for us in Explore and tap follow. We're also on Twitter. I'm at PTS Brian. And if politics in Kansas are of interest to you, I don't know why they would be, but if they are, you can follow my colleague Sam Zeff, the host of State House Blend Kansas, at Sam Zeff. If you want, you can find a shorter version of us on the air too on Tuesday mornings as part of Up to Date at 11 a.m. on KCUR 89.3. If you have any other thoughts, send me an email, brian@kcur.org. I'm Brian Ellison. Thanks for listening.